This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're really quite fortunate to have Professor Timothy Snyder with us today to talk about his new book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Professor Snyder was just telling me that this is the global premiere of his book. It's just out. Here it is, and as you can see, it's pretty slim. It's 5.5 inches by 7 inches and 126 pages, really merely just a fraction of the size of the award-winning books previously written by Professor Snyder, who's a prominent scholar of the Holocaust in Eastern Europe and who's been on Yale's faculty for 16 years. But don't be fooled by appearances. This tiny book is a very important one with a big set of messages. Writing amid widespread fear in this country of Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies, Professor Snyder draws on his own deep knowledge of what happened in Germany and the rest of Europe in the 20th century to caution against complacency, encourage resistance, and outline measures we could take to help prevent repression. Right at the start of the book, Professor Snyder warns against thinking that just because Americans have a democratic heritage, to think that we're somehow protected. He recalls how quickly some European democracies collapsed in the past century and contends, quote, "Americans today are no wiser than the Europeans who saw democracy yield to fascism, Nazism, or communism in the 20th century." The Washington Post's Carlos Lozada, in a recent review, noted that Professor Snyder's book, which is small enough really to fit in your pocket alongside a pocket-sized copy of the Constitution, Carlos Lozada said, quote, "It feels only slightly less vital than the Constitution." He called Professor Snyder's work, quote, "easily the most compelling volume among the resistance literature emerging in response to Trump." One of my favorite among the 20 lessons put forward by Professor Snyder has to do with not falling victim to groupthink or collective trances fomented by by propaganda and screens. Quote, "Make an effort to separate yourself from the internet," Professor Snyder urges. "Read books." Please join me in welcoming Professor Timothy Snyder.
Thank you very much. The book is meant to be small. It's meant to be something you can carry in your pocket. It's meant to be a kind of manifesto, precisely. It's meant to be something that's said quickly and briefly. It's meant to be to the point. I always tell my students that it's much harder to write short than it is to write long. I see all the people who are nodding, I'm going to assume are actual writers. or you teach writing, which is almost but not quite the same thing. So it's meant to be a manifesto and it's meant to be a manual. It's a highly normative book. It's meant to instruct you as to what you might do, what you can do, why you should do it, why it might work. In other words, unlike other books that I write, which are meant to be understood so that the past makes sense, this is a book which I wrote to help myself and to help others who live in our great republic change their everyday. Because changing your everyday is the only way to make history. Now, it rests upon the assumption that we are in a historical moment. There are times when what you do every day matters more. There are times when what you do every day matters less. This is a time when what you do every day matters more. And the reasons that I think that, or the reasons that I think that I can show that, have to do, as Brian was kind enough to say, have to do with what I've worked on before. They have to do with the fact that although I am an American, right, and although, and like I can do, like, you know, I baked apple pie, I was a Boy Scout, I can still throw a curveball, I mean, like, you know, whatever you want to throw at me. Although I am an American, most of my adult life has been spent either in Eastern Europe or at the very least learning languages, right? Much of my mental time, space has been spent learning, you know, German, Yiddish, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, French, so that I can understand the darker sides of the European 20th century. That I didn't do that so that I could comment on the U.S. in 2017, but it's one of the reasons why I feel that I can and maybe that I have to. Along the way, there are teachers, right? They're teachers. This is part of the story as well. It matters contiguity to people, people like Vladimir Tesmanianu. Hey, Vlad. Continuity. So it matters that my doctoral advisor was someone who survived the Holocaust in hiding as a child in Warsaw and who was also imprisoned by a communist regime. It matters that my doctoral examiner was someone who lost his job as a result of communism in Poland. It matters that the people I admired, later my friends, people like Adam Michnik or Václav Havel, were those who tried simultaneously to be thinkers and also to affect the everyday. It matters that in all of the moments that I'm discussing historically in this book, whether it's the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, whether it's Hitler coming to power in 1933, whether it's the communist coups or takeovers circa 1948 in Eastern Europe, whether it's the revolutions of 1989, it matters that there's a kind of genealogy, right? That I was in touch with people who experienced these things or who at the very least wrote about these things. This is my great privilege, right? That I had contiguity or still have in some cases contiguity contact with these people. And one thing that the book means to do is to put us back in touch with them, not just the ones that I'm happy enough to have known personally, but also people a bit older, Hannah Arendt, Viktor Klemperer, George Orwell, people of the mid-century who wrote wisely about the mid-century. It's meant to put us back into contact with many things which I think we once understood and which we don't anymore, or which we've forgotten, where our knowledge lies dormant, where it needs now to awaken. The third part of why I think I can write this book, well, I did write the book, but why I thought I thought it might be a reasonable thing to do to write a book. I mean, sometimes books happen, and more than any other book, this book happened because I thought it had to happen, right? There was something in me that thought it had to happen. This had to happen. This had to happen. But it has to do with 1989, not so much the revolutions of 1989, but the experience of watching a generation grow up in Eastern Europe in freedom, right? Of having friends who were younger colleagues, younger people whom I admire, who grew up in democracy and watched democracy slip away. It comes from now having my own students or people who studied with me who have been tortured or imprisoned or killed. It comes from that as well. It comes from the experience of seeing how things can turn, but also turn away. And the learning which is in the book is not just learning from the distant 20th century, it's also learning from the more recent 21st, from people who are sometimes my peers or people who are younger than me, who have already experienced many, precisely, in some cases, precisely the kinds of things we are just starting to experience, right? So some of the learning in this book is from people who were younger than me, and much of it comes from the very recent East European past. Okay, now, briefly, like, what are the things that I think that I've learned that stand behind the arguments that I make in this book? I'm going to try to summarize this in six fairly urgent points. The first is that it can happen, right? This business of regimes changing, the notion of no longer knowing what freedom feels like, the lack of certainty about what might be true, the sense that everything is slipping away and then it does, until it finally does slip away. That happens. It happens all the time. It happens all the time. It just hasn't happened to us, right? But it happens all the time. And since it can happen here, right? So I am not an American exceptionalist. I'm the opposite of American exceptionalist. I think if Americans at all believe the things that they say they believe, that means they should be proving them all the time, right? Missouri is the show me state. Show me. If Americans truly believe in all this business of freedom, show me, right? Show me. We have to show ourselves that it's true. I'm not an American exceptionalist. If it can happen, it can happen here. Second, relatedly, the people in history, whether it's Czechs in 1948 during a communist takeover, whether it's Germans in 1933 as Hitler's coming to power after winning an election where the left got more votes, regardless, these are people who are not so distant from ourselves and are not so different from ourselves. When I say they're people like us, I don't just mean that in a kind of broad, you know, meaningless sort of way. These are people with similar habits, similar attitudes, sometimes very similar life experiences. So if it can happen to them, it can happen to us. And if they can observe things, then we can learn things from them. The third thing, and this is important, is that it happens fast. It happens fast, right? I mean, there are a few clean-cut cases of revolution, but even when it's not a clean revolution, like 1917, even when it's not a clean revolution, a regime change only takes about 1 to 3 years. And if it only takes 1 to 3 years, that means that while you're looking around, the important things are already happening, right? They're already happening. They're already underway. And they happen fast, in part by making us feel that nothing at all is happening, right? That things are normal, or this was just a minor adjustment, or who knows really, or it was just a consultation, or it was just a courtesy visit. Things happen fast by making us experience life just in terms of the day-to-day. Oh, well, but today there weren't jackboots. Today there weren't jackboots today, right? As far as I know, I'm not entirely up. You know, I looked at the news 5 minutes ago, but as of 5 minutes ago, no jackboots, right? The way that things happen fast is by making us focus on the day-to-day and think, okay, well, I'm just going to adjust to what happened today. You know, tomorrow's another day. Maybe there won't be a total disaster tomorrow. You do that long enough and the disaster has arrived. The fourth thing that I think I've learned is that ideas are real. And ideas matter. And they matter whether or not you think they do. You can't make them not matter by not caring about them. It's very important to realize that people who aspire to power often have clear worldviews, right? The people who are in power now, I personally think, have rather clear worldviews, which we can't make go away by imagining that they're just some variant on something we know, that they're just like us, or they're just neoliberals, or whatever it might be. The ideas matter, and that ideas can actually, this is very simple, but they can actualize themselves, right? The people who made a revolution in 1917 had ideas. The people who took power in Germany in 1933 had ideas. The people who took over Czechoslovakia and other East European countries in the name of communism, they had ideas. The people who brought about the revolutions of 1989 had ideas. The people who reversed the revolutions of 1989, a trend in which we now partake. We are part of an ongoing worldwide east-to-west reversion against democracy, right? That is back to us. That's inside us now. We are now experiencing things that Russians and Ukrainians experienced already years ago. Those people had ideas. They all have ideas. And it's important to realize that not all ideas are just some variant of, you know, markets, liberalism, democracy, rule of law. They're very different ideas. There are still very different ideas. The hypnosis of the end of history is something that we have to break ourselves out of. The fifth thing that I think I've understood is that the catalyst, or if you want, the lubricant of regime change is mistrust, right? The sense of uncertainty, the sense that nothing is real or nothing is true. If you are having that feeling now, as many Americans are, you are right where Russians were about a decade ago, okay? They're much further along now, right? They're in a different place now, as people say. But if you have that sense that you don't know who to trust, is journalism real, is history real, you know, should I listen to white men wearing ties? Actually, the answer is generally no, right? But make an exception, right? I feel like Sean Spicer has totally ruined this look for me. But I don't know where else to go. So, like, maybe you can help me out afterwards. Anyway, that mistrust is the lubricant. Mistrust makes it happen, right? Because if you don't think anything's true and you don't trust anyone, then the rule of law can't work. And if the rule of law can't work, then democracy is going to fall, right? Democracy depends on the rule of law. Rule of law depends on a certain basic level of trust. That basic level of trust is not that we agree about everything, but that we agree there's a world and there are facts in it. If you lose that, then you lose rule of law, then you lose democracy, right? And the people who are going after trust, the people who are tweeting random things at 5:30 in the morning, right? They are consciously ripping out the heart of democracy. It's not the skin, right? It's not the muscles. It's not the bones. It's going right for the heart. It's skipping the step of democracy, right? It's going right for the heart. It's ripping out the thing which makes democracy possible. The final thing, the sixth thing that I think I've understood, this is going to sound really simple, but it's so important, is that authoritarianism is built with the help of us, right? Even totalitarianism, it's built with the help of the people. It's very hard to do it without the people. The people don't think they're helping, they think they're just adjusting or they're just reacting, whatever it might be. But all of these systems depend upon people adjusting and helping, which means that everyone has a little bit more power than you think you have, right? It means that everyone has a bit of power. It means that your actions matter, especially right now, quite a bit. But they have to be fast. They have to be fast, right? They have to be fast. Okay. So this book was my little attempt to follow these things that I'm recommending and that I think I understand. It came really quickly, right? So if the book exists now, I mean, those of you who know anything about publishing will understand this, right? The 20 lessons I wrote on November 15th, the book I did between the middle of December and Christmas, right? If it's February 28th, right? So most of the time has been spent in the actual physical publication of the book. We could have brought it out much earlier, but my publishers quite rightly said that's not fair to the bookstores, right? I wanted to bring it out electronically on Inauguration Day, which would have been technically possible, right? But then we wouldn't have had the bookstores, and I'm glad to have the bookstores, and I'll take this opportunity to thank Politics and Prose for hosting this launch. Yeah, because although I'm about to read a different lesson, the one about books is really important to me, and I have this idea that the independent bookstores are going to carry this book. Okay, so I'm going to read a couple of the lessons from the book because they get across what I'm trying to say. I think about this book being for me a kind of homecoming. That is bringing the things I think I understand from my teachers, from the history, from my younger peers, home to the United States. I'll read the first lesson. Also because it's the one because it's meant to be at the beginning. Things get darker, but this is the one that's maybe most appropriate for the now. And then I'm going to read the second to last one. I'm not going to read the last one, but I'll read the second to last one, which also maybe bears a little bit on today. And I'm just going to emphasize the point. If these things ring true, remember that I wrote them a month before the inauguration, right? So if you're like, if you're wondering whether one can make sort of informed hunches or guesses on the basis of history and patterns and recognizing patterns, if any of this sounds right to you today, right, just remember that I wrote it months before the inauguration. Okay, all right. Lesson number one is, do not obey in advance. Most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. Anticipatory obedience is political tragedy. Perhaps rulers did not initially know that citizens were willing to compromise this value or that principle. Perhaps a new regime did not at first have the direct means of influencing citizens one way or another. After the German elections of 1932, which permitted Adolf Hitler to form a government, or the Czechoslovak elections of 1946, where communists were victorious, the next crucial step was anticipatory obedience. Because enough people in both cases voluntarily extended their services to the new leaders, Nazis and communists alike realized they could move quickly towards a full regime change. The first heedless acts of conformity could not then be reversed. Okay, I'm going to skip now to the end of the lecture, the end of this lesson, because it has the bit of the homecoming part. Because now we're going to go from the things that I learned to a building where I teach at Yale. So, at the very beginning, anticipatory obedience means adapting instinctively without reflecting to a new situation. Do only Germans do such things? The Yale psychologist Stanley Milgram, contemplating Nazi atrocities, wanted to show that there was a particular authoritarian personality that explained why Germans behaved as they had. He devised an experiment to test the proposition, but failed to get permission to carry it out in Germany. So he undertook it instead in a Yale University building in 1961, at around the same time that Adolf Eichmann was being tried in Jerusalem for his part in the Nazi Holocaust of the Jews. Milgram told his subjects, some of them Yale students, some of them New Haven residents, that they would be applying an electric shock to other participants in an experiment about learning. In fact, the people attached to the wires on the other side of a window were in on the scheme with Milgram and only pretended to be shocked. As the subjects thought they shocked the people they thought were participants in this experiment, they saw a horrible sight. People whom they did not know and against whom they had no grievance seemed to be suffering greatly, pounding the glass and complaining of heart pain. Even so, most subjects followed Milgram's instructions and continued to apply what they thought were ever greater shocks until the victims appeared to die. Even those who did not proceed all the way to the apparent killing of their fellow human beings left without inquiring about the health of the other participants. Milgram grasped that people are remarkably receptive to new rules in a new setting. They're surprisingly willing to harm and kill others in the service of some new purpose if they are so instructed by a new authority. Quote, I found so much obedience, Milgram remembered, that I hardly saw the need for taking the experiment to Germany. So that's number one, do not obey in advance. All the way down at number 19 is the one about patriotism. In general, the ones towards the end of the book are meant to come later, but you know, sometimes events outpace you or catch you up, as Wittgenstein liked to say, catch you up. Be a patriot. Set a good example of what America means for the generations to come. They will need it. What is patriotism? Let us begin with what patriotism is not. It is not patriotic to dodge the draft and to mock war heroes and their families. It is not patriotic to discriminate against active duty members of the armed forces in one's companies or to campaign to keep disabled veterans away from one's property. It is not patriotic to compare one's search for sexual partners in New York with the military service in Vietnam that one has dodged. It is not patriotic to avoid paying taxes, especially when American working families do pay. It is not patriotic to ask those working, tax-paying American families to finance one's own presidential campaign and then to spend their contributions in one's own companies. It is not patriotic to admire foreign dictators. It is not patriotic to cultivate a relationship with Muammar Gaddafi or to say that Bashar al-Assad and Vladimir Putin are superior leaders. It is not patriotic to call upon Russia to intervene in an American presidential election. It is not patriotic to cite Russian propaganda at rallies. It is not patriotic to share an advisor with Russian oligarchs. It is not patriotic to solicit foreign policy advice from someone who owns shares in a Russian energy company. It is not patriotic to read a foreign policy speech written by someone on the payroll of a Russian energy company. It is not patriotic to appoint a national security advisor who has taken money from a Russian propaganda organ. It is not patriotic to appoint a Secretary of State, an oil man with Russian financial interests, who is the director of a Russian-American energy company and has received the Order of Friendship from Putin. The point is not that Russia and America must be enemies. The point is that patriotism involves serving your own country. The president is a nationalist, which is not at all the same thing as a patriot. A nationalist encourages us to be our worst and then tells us that we are the best. A nationalist, quote, although endlessly brooding on power, victory, defeat, revenge, wrote Orwell, tends to be, quote, uninterested in what happens in the real world, unquote. Nationalism is relativist, since the only truth is the resentment we feel when we contemplate others. As the novelist Daniel Kish put it, nationalism, quote, has no universal values, aesthetic or ethical. A patriot, by contrast, wants the nation to live up to its ideals, which means asking us to be our best selves. a patriot must be concerned with the real world, which is the only place where his country can be loved and sustained. A patriot has universal values, standards by which he judges his nation, always wishing it well, and wishing that it would do better. Democracy failed in Europe in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, and it is failing not only in much of Europe, but in many parts of the world today. It is that history and experience that reveals to us the dark range of our possible futures. A nationalist will say that it can't happen here, which is the first step towards disaster. A patriot says that it could happen here, but that we will stop it. Thank you. And so another thing which comes from my East European experience is the part where I say, you should please ask your question in the form of a question, right? Which everyone always laughs at and says, oh, those East Europeans, right? Right? And if you wouldn't mind telling me who you are, because though I do see some people I know, I don't unfortunately know all of you. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Melissa Omerberg. My question is that in view of the various developments that we've seen since the inauguration, like the Women's March, the town halls, the various indivisible groups and so forth, where do you see us right now on the trajectory toward or away from tyranny?
So it's a big country and it's a complicated history. I would say on the one side, things are generally darker than we want to think. Right. So on the one side, we are hit day by day by day with things that we don't even really have time to fully assimilate before the next thing comes along. And that itself is the nature of regime change, that you get hit by so much bad news right at the beginning that you're meant to say, oh, what can I do? And the thing is, some of the news really is bad. And it's, you know, I mean, a little thing like, you know, banning the New York Times from the press room at the White House, right? Which, you know, a few years ago would have been like the scandal of the decade, completely gets lost in the shuffle today, right? So on the one side, I think things are worse than people generally want them to be, right? Like, so for example, if you watch, I didn't watch it, right? I just read the transcript, which is like one of my ways of staying sane. I read a lot of transcripts. I think it's a lot healthier to read transcripts because you pick up more of what people are saying. You're less likely to be fooled by delivery mechanisms and so on. And also, like, you control when you read transcripts and other people control when stuff is broadcast, you know, just little tricks like this. But, you know, the coverage of the speech the other day, right, where people want to say, oh, like, this makes it all normal. Like, when even in that speech, there were things which were severely awful. Like, you know, having the victims of crimes carried out by people of certain ethnicity, right? That's just dreadful, right? I mean, any victim of a crime deserves our sympathy, but the ones who are victims of crimes committed by certain groups are not worthy of more or special sympathy. That's implicitly stigmatizing a group, and that was the real story, right, of that speech, which almost nobody, at least in, you know, in the big outlets, was covering. So on the one side, things are worse than we think, right? On the other side, yeah. I mean, my standard, as you might have gathered, is Germans in 1932 and 33. That's my standard. And by that standard, there are a couple of things that are encouraging. One is the speed, right, that Muslims and Jews, but importantly, not just Muslims and Jews, recognize the Muslim ban as not being, you know, even mainly about Muslims. It's mainly about establishing a certain kind of politics. Because if you can establish that a small assimilated group is in fact part of a worldwide threat, then you're changing the nature of politics. Then there's no domestic politics anymore. Then it's all about threats which you identify at home because they're part of this vague thing abroad, right? Which is just what Germany did with the Jews in 1933. Many Americans were quick to notice that, even if they wouldn't have articulated it quite the way I did, right? People were fast to notice that. That was encouraging. And the other thing which is encouraging for me are the lawyers, right? So there are two great, like, I'm going to show my, like, pro-German sympathies here. There were two great, like, legal traditions in, you know, in the part of the world I'm familiar with, which is European history, that there's the German and there's the Anglo-Saxon. And the German pride in Rechtsstaat is totally, you know, very much justified. But the lawyers generally shifted the lawyers generally went to the other side. They found ways of making law not universal but particular, right? Or as so Hans Frank, who was the Governor General of Poland and who was personally responsible for the deaths of countless human beings, Jews, Poles, and others, he was Hitler's personal lawyer. Right, the majority of the Einsatzgruppen commanders, the people who were in charge of the mass shootings of Jews, handicapped, communists, Poles, and others, gypsies, they were people with law degrees, right? So that was a failure of the lawyers. From my you know, anecdotal perspective here, the American lawyers are doing better. Right, the American lawyers are doing better. I'm not all of them, right? Because like Kellyanne Conway is a lawyer, right? Right, isn't she? And Sessions is, you know, a lawyer until he gets disbarred, right? But why is that funny? I mean, he perjured himself, and he should be disbarred, right? And you know, right? He perjured himself; he should be disbarred. I think that's a rule. So the lawyers are doing better, right? And then also like the one of my lessons here is corporeal politics, that you got to get your body into places. You got to get yourself out of the internet, out of your basement, you know, out of your parents' basement, your kids' basement, whatever it is, out of the basement, out into the real world, and meet people that you don't know and with whom you don't agree about everything, and protest. That's very important. And Americans have been okay about that, you know, better than I had expected. Mm-hmm. So, long answer, yeah. Sir.
Yes, name is Jules Bernstein. I have read your book in the last day or two. And I have to say, I put it in a class with Common Sense and Tom Paine terms of having influence or having potential influence on a big wake-up call to the people in this country.
Thank you.
So I congratulate you for having done this and done it so quickly.
Thank you.
I especially like the fact that in the book you referenced the Polish Solidarity Movement as something that began in 81 and then continued and then was there when it really needed to be there. And I would have to say that whether it's Indivisible or Our Revolution or all of these other groups that are emerging are our response. And I'm really pleased, but I didn't expect it to be so substantial in terms of response. My question is along the same lines that the woman just asked the question a little while ago. How do you see this projecting forward in terms of Trump and Bannon and their perspective? I do see the Republicans basically going along, get along, go along. Is where they are. You don't see anything happening in their ranks to basically oppose. So any reaction on that?
Okay, so first of all, thank you. Thank you for your very kind words. This is the most American thing I have ever done, or at least like the most American thing. Sorry, this is by far the most American thing I've ever done, and it's not accidental that I begin with the founders, because the founders, in their imperfect but nevertheless impressive wisdom, realized that the threat to their system was going to come from within. Right. So the whole system is set up to hold off threats from within. And that's an important moral lesson, right? And that, because the threat now is definitely from within. And if we think it can't happen here, then we're making exactly the opposite move that the founders made. The founders' whole set of assumptions began with assumption number one: this democratic republic experiment is threatened from the very beginning because of us, right? That's where they started from. And if we, you know, if we forget that, then we've taken the first step towards losing everything. What, am I away from the microphone? Okay, sorry. So the second part of what you said was solidarity. I completely agree, right? And some of the middle lessons, as you know, are about civil society. And the people who end up in some good variant of what happens, the people who end up being president 5, 10, 2, whatever years down the line, are going to be are going to be people who were not in politics before, right? Who are going to be people who were politicized by this moment. So this book is for everybody, but it was really written for people in their 20s, right? That's like the epilogue is all about young people. And it came from my talking to people in their 20s who were surprised by how history has turned, and my trying to explain to them that history isn't a thing that turns, right? It's a whole lot of things at the same time, and some of them you can get your hands around and turn yourself. And that precisely at this moment, this is a moment about, you can't think like just because you thought everything was going to go well, now you accept that everything's going to go badly. No, like it's up to you. It's completely up to you. But I agree with you completely. There's a constellation which is forming, and people will come out of that constellation who will end up in standard. And what you say is so important. It links to your question about the Republicans, because, I mean, the Democratic Party isn't going to do this, right? I wish them well and all, but they're not going to do this. They're not going to do it alone. For this to change, and now I'm going to go all like middle of the road on you. For this to change, it's not just going to be a matter of people who already think sort of like this intensifying and acting. It's going to be a matter of them convincing other people, not everybody, but it's going to be a matter of like the middle 10 or 15% swinging. That'll be enough. That'll be enough. And I mean Republicans who are in elected office, and I mean people who voted for Trump, right? Many of whom, in my opinion, did so for understandable reasons. It's going to involve people a certain swing towards the middle, and we can't forget about that. Yeah.
Great.
Go ahead. Okay. Hello. My name is Stacey Small-Lorenz, and I was the lead organizer in Maryland for the Women's March. Yeah. And my sign for the march, thank you. that's not what I was going for, but thank you. My sign, without having read this lovely volume, said, "Tyranny thrives on complacency."
Yeah, yeah.
I also teach bystander intervention, which are simple techniques to de-escalate hostility and harassment when you witness it on the street. And so I love your lesson number 12, make eye contact and small talk. And I was hoping you could elaborate a little on why making eye contact and small talk can actually be a political and revolutionary act.
Okay. So first of all, thank you for what you did. One of the things, going back to the very first question, that did encourage me was how smart a lot of the signage was at the marches, right? Like, because I was sort of like, I had, by the time any march happened, I had already finished the book, right? Mm-hmm. So the book was done and it was in press and all that. But then I saw like all these clever people saying clever things, which I was very impressed by. And then my writing comes off as very sober compared to a lot of the things that my 4-year-old still chants.
I love it.
Yeah. okay. So, right. So with the eye contact, there are a lot of things going on here, which range from the sort of the constructive to the defensive. One of them is that I'm trying to stress that if politics is going to change, it's going to change starting from, you know, dyads and triads. It's going to start from small relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Small groups. It's easy to say act locally. It's become kind of a cliche. And what I'm trying to get after is more like that your everyday life is already political now, because authority is already political whether you like it or not, right? Like the personal, in this book, the personal is political, but in a slightly different way than I was taught that the personal is political, right? It's not so much about people caring about how I feel, which I'd like to hope they don't. It's about how the world reacts to everything you do, right? Mm-hmm. So, we are already now in an authoritarian moment, which means that everyday life is already political, whether we like it or not, which means that everything we do is already political. So, with the eye contact, I have in mind, from my own perspective, what I have in mind is all the memoirs, whether it's from the Stalinist terror or whether it's from Jews in the early 30s, about seeing the first time their friends cross the street, right, to avoid contact, right, and just how important that is. For them to realize, okay, if that person is not making eye contact with me anymore, then something very seriously wrong is happening. But there's also, at least now, right? Now, if you do make eye contact with people who might feel that they're threatened, you can change things. You can make that. You can encourage them, right? The things which might just seem like everyday courtesy now do become political, right? They have, yes. they have social importance, and we should probably all try to do more of it. And personally, like, eye contact and small talk, especially the small talk, are not my strong points, right? So like this is one that I'm working on personally, is the small talk.
I'm feeling small talk.
But the idea that, like, you don't, so if you look out into, you don't know who's feeling excluded, but like, damn, we know some people are feeling like, you don't know at a glance maybe, but you know that a lot of people are. And so, you know, if you affirm everyone, then you're doing your part to kind of bring people in, and that has an effect. The defensive part, you know, the sadder part, is that if we do shift towards authoritarianism, it's very important to know people personally, because you need, like, old, I say in the book, that, like, old friends are the politics of last resort. I mean, that's just something that I know, like, old friends are where you have to go in the end, and new friends are the first step towards a new politics. No. Well, there we are.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Here?
Sorry.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a physician now, but I graduated from Yale Law School in 1972. I knew Hillary. There weren't that many women. And I was horrified by the big lie. Hillary is corrupt. Yeah, yeah. Hillary should go to jail. Hillary is a criminal. And by how widespread that became, I mean, that was absurd. And there didn't seem to be any counter to it. It's the big lie, the Orwell big lie. What do we do about something like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people who should have known better who just repeated it mindlessly in the medical literature of all places.
Okay. So I don't have a silver bullet for that, but I do have some ways of trying to
sure.
get one's mind around it. The first is that is technological. I mean, it just turns out that the internet does not open the broad sweep towards the positive globalization that Al Gore was dreaming of, right, in the 1990s. Right. That just isn't true. Just like it wasn't true of the book, which brought us the wars of religion, right? Just like it wasn't true of radio, which brought us fascism. All of these new, I mean, not alone, right? But all of these new technologies are extremely unpredictable for some, like, transition period that may last 100 years, right? They're very unpredictable. So this is a bubble that I think Hillary Clinton herself was caught in, her campaign was caught in, people on the East Coast were caught in. People did not realize what the internet actually was, right? Mm-hmm. What it was actually doing. And this is, I mean, there's an empirical thing here and there's a technical thing here. The empirical thing is people just did not realize how siloed off we had become. I didn't realize it until I actually started talking when I was canvassing and talking to Trump voters in the Midwest. And then I realized, like, and this is so dumb, but it was at that moment that I realized just how different my Facebook feed was from other people's. Because if you hear from what seemed to be 25 independent sources that Hillary Clinton is a murderer, and you've been hearing it for 6 months, right. you might well believe it, right?
Right?
I mean, that's not
people
surprising,
did.
Which is the technical thing. Not enough people, again, like Clinton campaign, whatever, realized that Donald Trump actually had a campaign advantage, right? We talked incessantly about, you know, ground game. I saw the ground game. In the ground game, which is below the ground game, right? In what the Russians call the psychosphere, Trump had a tremendous advantage. How much of that was actually his campaign and how much of it was actually the Russians, I don't know. But in terms of the bots, in terms of the technical distribution of the false news, the generation and technical distribution, he had a huge advantage. Mm-hmm. And what turned out almost certainly to be a decisive advantage. These are things that we have to understand and get our mind around. Now, in terms of what we can do, I mean, obviously, like, you know, Zuckerberg can do a lot, and people who are in charge of news distribution can do a lot. There are two little things. I mean, one is kind of just a declaration. I think 2017 is already and is going to be a heroic year for journalism. I mean, I absolutely mean heroic. Like, if this is going to turn around, it's going to be because of people pursuing old-fashioned stories in old-fashioned ways and printing them and publishing them very often in print journals who can afford, or at least try to afford to be able to do such things. And I mean, it's also generationally, like, there are a lot of really interesting young people who now see journalism as edgy, and they're right? Like, the whole the phrase mainstream media, that's not, like, what's mainstream is the derision of the media. that's the mainstream, right? Being a journalist is now edgy and dangerous and interesting, right? And I think maybe historically meaningful. And, you know, the little thing I say in the book, which is obvious, and I'm sure you all do it, is that we need to pay for a bunch of subscriptions. Because if everybody pays for subscriptions, that will actually be enough to subsidize investigations, right? And that, I mean, even we know that people like us often don't do that, right? And if we all did it, that would make a huge difference. And then finally, there's the internet self-policing, which is, we have to remember that we are all now publishers, right? And so therefore, every individual makes a difference in terms of what is actually being distributed, right? And if we think about it that way, then each of us it'll make us feel better too, right? Like if you pick reporters from the real world, follow their work, get to know them, as it were, and then distribute their work online, then you're being a publisher who's doing a little bit of good. So at like the day-to-day level, that's something that we can do.
Thank you, and I certainly intend to pick up the book.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm Berenike Schott, and I'm interested in hearing a little more, less about the content of the book and more about your process in getting there. So as an academic, and I think in this city, the reason why I'm asking is there are a lot of people who are very informed politically, but they may not want to be too engaged because they're journalists or they work for the government or they're academics. And
doesn't that mean they're already engaged?
Isn't
that the problem?
So I'm interested specifically as a historian to make this decision, which I'm sure you know you were thinking about before, of taking a stance on current politics. What did that decision-making process look like, and what would you recommend to others in academia, be it in political science or history or other professions who may be struggling with this question, if this is what we're studying, to what degree should we make statements about current politics, if you have any.
Okay, so I'm afraid that what I have to say may just be like too simple to be useful. I did my best with it in the little introduction. Because of what I work on, I feel a sense of the weight of this. Right. This is not for me like one more form of entertainment or one more narrative or whatever it might be. This is really happening, and it can go places that are very dark. And I wanted to think that I had done the thing that I could do in time. It's as simple as that. There's nothing more to it than that. Right. If people don't think that this is really happening, or if they don't think it's dark, okay, I think they're wrong, right? But if you think it's happening and you think it's dark, then you have to do the thing that you can do. It's as simple as that. I didn't want to look back. And I'm just describing to you why I wrote the 20 lessons on November 15th. I didn't want to look back and think I didn't do everything I could do, right? And the thing is, it sounds silly, but like everybody can do something. And if everybody does something, even if it's small, that's going to make a huge difference. So I don't actually, like, I could have a long debate with like my colleagues in DC about like engagement and the history and so on. But for me, like, this is a complete and absolute no-brainer, right? If you care about the constitutional system of the United States, if you care about the rule of law, if you want to have children who have some notion of what the word freedom means, this is all for me a complete no-brainer. And you got to do it now. Because the moment you start talking to yourself about all the reasons you're not doing it, you are partaking in the regime change, right? It's simple for me. This is simple for me. Sorry, that's as interesting as it's going to get. Thanks.
Hello.
Sorry.
My name is Elka Kotari. Quick backstory to the purpose of my question, or the story of my question. I teach about India. I'm specifically a Gujarati Jain, and I began writing and cooking and teaching about India in the joy of Obama. Because Whoopi Goldberg was asked this thing that I found out lots of people heard and started crying. People who are not black, the president looked like me only in some sort of biracial mix, right? But she said, I thought I was an American. I was born here. Mm-hmm. It was the first blue passport in my family. She said on the day of the election, she felt she could put her suitcase down and finally unpack. And it is with that joy that for the last eight years, I have done my work. On November 9th, I started outing my own, because I think a lot of people in this room don't realize I can speak specifically for my own people, but I know it goes for every kind of color and religious minority. Indians have known, non-Muslim Indians have hated Muslims over a millennium of oppression. They have known and taught me, I don't hate them, but in a way that this country didn't even know how to pronounce the word until recently. So that once Trump came along, here's this group of people that I know go home for Thanksgiving and have voted for him. And there was nothing. There were campaigns from children trying to explain, your money will not protect you. It did not protect Jews. What do you not understand about this? And all I've heard is, it cannot happen to us. And in order to not give myself a bloody aneurysm, I had to stop. I had to leave. Because now I'm in trouble with my mother for being disrespectful to everyone I was raised around. And their children are thinking these things. And now Indians who have not been problematic in this country are being shot in the street repeatedly in the last few weeks. All of that is to say, you surely know, there are many groups in America who you would think Trump and his people are against, who are supporting this because they do not believe that anyone will come for them, or they believe that when somebody has a gun, they're going to ask, oh, are you a Jain? Oh, you're a vegetarian, so you wouldn't kill anybody. Nobody's asking that. It's just your other to me. So how do all of us speak to those who do not see what is coming, who are not white?
Okay, so that may be a couple levels deeper than I can go, but I'm gonna try. So this goes to the prior gentleman's question, Mr. Bernstein's question too. I think there's going to be a lot of political and social realignment happening. People being offended by people they didn't expect to be offended by, offending people they didn't expect to be offending, you know, their families, for example, and making alliances with people they didn't expect to be making alliances with. I think there's going to be a lot of that going on. I think there's going to be a lot of questioning about what it actually means to be American, right? So like this is going to sound like a weird connection, but you'll see what I mean. When I first moved abroad and I was living in Eastern Europe and didn't know languages, and I was just kind of lonely, I could always like spot Americans on the street, but which ones could I spot most easily? I could most easily spot African Americans, right? Because there weren't that many people of African origin in the places where I was, and African Americans move like Americans, right? So you can tell who's an American. And like, I always thought, okay, there's one of mine, right? Like, over there, okay, that's good, right? That's nice. There's one of mine over there, right? And then I had that like, and then after this election, so you see where this is going to go, right? So after this election, I look at white people. I think, like, how could most of you, right? And I look at black people, and I think, okay, like, at least these people, probably okay, this is probably going to be fine, right? And this has kind of changed my dinner party habits and all kinds of things, right? But,
oh, yes.
But it's just by way of saying, like, there's going to be some shaking up that's happening, right? Pleasantly and unpleasantly along these lines. I don't have a better answer to your specific question than the one you've already given, which is that history shows precisely what you say, that people who think they could buy their way out, which was, that was the totally normal mainstream view of German Jews, and I cited in the book, right? That's in lesson two in the book, is that the people who thought they were assimilated, basically thought this was the mainstream view. Hitler comes to power, he doesn't really mean it. And if he does mean it, it's only going to be for those old students, right? In the worst case, it's going to be for those recent migrants. We don't have anything to worry about. That was the dominant view. That wasn't just some eccentric thing. That's what most people thought, right? So if anything, we may be slightly better than German Jews in 1933. But all I can say is, like, you're exactly right about the history. The history shows that that's not how it works at all, because the politics of exclusion and regime change is not about, exactly as you say, it's not about the specificities of who believes what, right? It's not about whether Jews are actually communists or terrorists, right? Any more than it's actually about whether blacks are, you know, super predators or Muslims or terrorists. It's not about that. It's not about the vegetarianism or the not, right? It's about a method where you destroy your own society by linking one group to some kind of world threat. And once you've done it once, the game is over. Because once you've done it once, you can then keep going. So, I mean, that's a logic I try to explain in the book. I'm afraid I can't do better than that, answering your question.
No, thank you. The little coda I'll add to it is the debate going on amongst liberals about whether we should play identity politics. My answer has always been, they did it. I have constitutional rights. I'm not asking for anything more than a white person has. I'm asking that everybody stop taking something away based on it.
That's different.
Yeah.
No, the promise of America is a hell of a lot, and we're a long way from getting there, right? So, yeah, all right.
Yeah. Thank you.
My name is Eleanor Backrack. I worked for USAID in Ukraine in the late 90s, so I appreciate what you've said and written about that situation, the current one, but getting to our situation, when I wrote my holiday letter in December, I said, I'm beginning to realize how fragile our democracy is. And I guess you're saying that you don't think I was overstating it. And I was just talking about the fact that there are certain implicit understandings, like the candidate showing his tax returns, removing conflicts of interest, being civil, that Trump was just able to ignore with no consequences. But finally, in terms of the real spine of our democracy, the Constitution, there have been at various times surveys that showed that, for instance, if you stated the First Amendment a different way, people would be against it. I mean, we really can't assume that everybody believes in the Constitution, even though they may feel they do. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, there was this line that I was saving for another occasion, which is that your Second Amendment rights aren't going to matter much when there's no Constitution. So since I may not have a chance to say that where I want to say it, I'll go ahead and get it out now. I have a couple of thoughts about that. The first is that this on your introduction, we don't have to agree like exactly what the nature of the threat is in order to do things. Right. So I tend to see certain things, other people see other things. But the important thing is to realize that a general transformation is underway and then decide that one wants to stop it, which leads to your second question. I think the cleavages, it goes again back to the very first question, that the question we just had, the cleavages are going to change. They're already changing. In Europe, it's further along than here because certain things are further along in Europe than here. But I think the real dividing lines are fact and post-fact and anti-authoritarianism and authoritarianism. And I think I agree with your premise. The anti-authoritarian case is unfortunately a case that has to be made, right? It can lose. But I think that's the case that has to be made. And it goes back to how one wins also. The anti-authoritarians have to include a good deal of, in my view, conservatives, people who vote Republican, right? People who think there should be a constitution, although they would disagree about policy, you know, perhaps with me, right? Mm-hmm. The anti-authoritarian camp is going to have to include a lot of folks like that as well. So my answer is that, of course, you're right. I mean, the Bill of Rights is there for the reason you give. That's why the Bill of Rights is there. It's not there because it's popular. It's there because it would be unpopular, right? Who wants to separate church and state? It'd be so much more fun to have my, you know, my church, right? I mean, who's not tempted by that, right? Few people. Okay, so like, okay, I was going to list all. I didn't want to favor anybody. There are a few denominations who would maybe not be, but in general, like you belong to a rare tradition if you belong to a tradition which has never tried to take over the state at some point or found a state, right? So how is dividing church and state popular? It's not meant to be popular. It's meant to be sensible. These things are not meant to be popular. And so that means they have to be defended precisely. But I think there is enough of a consensus around constitution that one can at least start there as a way of shaming people or gathering people. But I mean, my basic notion is that it goes down very deep. It's whether you're going to be authoritarian or anti-authoritarian. And the people who are trying to change things already know they're authoritarian, right? So here we are.
Just one other comment. When Hillary Clinton stated at the time that Russia was taking over Crimea and invading, and she compared it to Sudetenland takeover, and everybody scoffed at her. She had to pull it back, but I don't know whether you thought that was more apt than some did.
Well, I mean, Andrei Zubov, who's a very gifted and conservative Russian historian, made the same comparison, and lost his job for it. No, of course it's apt, right? Mm-hmm. So here's how Americans generally deal with history. the Americans deal with history as though history were an MP3. And if it doesn't sound exactly the same when you punch the button as it did the previous time, then you think something's wrong, right? That's what Americans say. If it doesn't repeat perfectly, so if Americans will say, oh, well, there are no swastikas, there are no jackboots, I'm changing the channel. I'm afraid like that's our national response to history. This whole taboo thing about the 1930s is a way of saying, well, in the naive view, it's a way of saying, okay, we don't know anything about history and that's fine, right? Because no analogy is going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, Crimean Sudetenland is actually an extremely good analogy. It's a very close mm-hmm. analogy, right? But none's going to be perfect, right? And so mm-hmm. saying, oh, that's just an analogy, or that's a way of just not thinking about history. And once you don't think about history, you're done. You're finished. Because history is the only thing which teaches you how people have successfully resisted. It's also the only thing which teaches you how institutions are constructed, right? So the moment you say, oh, no comparisons, you're done. Forget it, right? It's over. So it's a very dangerous move. And in the dark version, the non-naive version, in the dark version, it's quite deliberate. You know, you say, well, I am not exactly like Hitler, and therefore it's okay, right? And we're getting to that point, right? You know, nothing is wrong. I'm overstating this slightly, but not much. Nothing is wrong because there aren't concentration camps yet. No. You know, and there weren't concentration camps in January 1933 either, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. My name is.
I keep losing that. Yeah. Hey,
it's all good. My name is Christopher Greggs. So one question, it was kind of a two-part question. So what you're discussing is by these small adaptions that we make in the face of potential tyranny is kind of our contributing and kind of providing a platform to power. And the people who I guess are given the most time to make those adjustments are people who believe that they have the most space between what is happening in their everyday lives. So two-part question: who do you think? What groups in this country do you think have the least amount of time before they're directly affected by tyranny? And what different types of privileges exist in this country socioeconomically that may be a danger to lean into this moment? And how can we stay present by not kind of leaning into what we believe has kept us safe, whether it be citizenship, race, and religion, so on and so forth?
Can you spell that out a little bit more? Cause I think you have a thought in mind when you ask that question.
Oh, yeah, sure. So yeah. So who's in danger? Who's the closest? Right. What groups are in danger the closest in this moment? And what privileges should we be checking when we think about and we kind of fall into these ideas of I'm not X, so I'm safe. I'm not Y, so I have less to be fearful for in this moment.
Okay, thanks. So, I mean, that in some way that falls into this question. Like it's a kind of prognostic. It's about forecasting, which is a little hard. But I'm going to make some general remarks that maybe are relevant. So I think this, like the question about Indians and Muslims and the Jain, this touches on something which is really important about the politics of creating an authoritarian regime, which is that it almost doesn't matter where you start. You can start in a lot of different places. And we start in our country right now, we're starting with the Muslims. It so happens, which means in a direct way, right, Muslims are obviously most threatened, and recent immigrants, right? That's everyone knows that, and that's the obvious thing. But the people, this is where it gets paradoxical, the people who join in are also the targets. In fact, they're the main targets, right? The main target are not the Muslims. The main target are the other Americans who will join in. Because once you join in, you've accepted rules of engagement, which can then be applied to you, right? Which is why your second point about checking privilege is so absolutely correct. It has to be along the lines of, everybody in the body politic, everybody trying to preserve the body politic. Because if we don't everybody try to preserve the body politic, then it's going to go away, right? Then it's going to go away. Now, I would add, since it's about America, I'm going to add a couple footnotes on this, which is that there are some people who have a certain kind of intuition about these things that other people may not have. So I'm going to now have a rare moment of white person guilt. It's important for people who assumed, okay, in my life, the people who thought that Trump could win, all right, were three kinds of people. People who, I'm looking for Tismaniano again, people who worked on fascism in the 20s and 30s, people who live in Eastern Europe now, right? And African Americans in my life. I don't know how representative that is, right? But those were sort of the three groups who thought, okay, this could happen, right? This, not necessarily it will, but this could happen. And I understand the first two groups pretty well, right? Because that's what I work on. Like, and it was really striking. Like, I had a Ukrainian reporter friend who, like, she landed in Ohio, and basically, like, within 45 minutes, she correctly forecast the, and we'd been working on it for like 2 years, right? 2 years, and she was there for 45 minutes. She sent me a text, and she's like, "Yeah, there's a lot of misogyny here. Trump's going to take this state. It's over, right? Okay, you know, all right, fine. You know, we got some models over here, but you know, who was right? Who was right? The people who were right were the people who had dipped in one way or another to this phenomenon before. Which means that, and this is actually something I say in the book, which means that there's a whole lot of listening that has to happen, right? So, like, I don't always know exactly what check your privilege means, but I know that there's a lot of listening that has to go on. That people who were in various kinds of bubbles which made them think that this couldn't happen, that means that there's something you didn't understand about the society, right? And then so if you meet somebody who did have a sense of how it go this way, then you just then there's some listening to be done. That's as far as I can really go there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Tim, we're technically out of time. There's a lot of interest, so you want
to
take a few more?
I'm happy to stay. I mean, there are a lot of people here who probably have other, like, I don't know, things to do, but I'm happy to stay. I don't have anything else to do. I mean, this is why I'm here, right? I mean,
Hi, I was here, my name is Susan Hewitt. I was here the other day when Senator Sheldon Whitehouse spoke about his book of Corporate Influence in Democracy. I think it's called, I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, Captured. So where do we, the phenomena of CPACs and like really powerful interest groups, and do we even have an independent Supreme Court now? You know, like, can you talk about that a little bit? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we fight against that? It's mm-hmm. hard to see it. Mm-hmm. I'm a fairly newly awakened political being, so I can't speak to it as thoroughly as I'd like to, but mm-hmm. that does seem to be something that's, according to Senator Whitehouse, really huge and really under the radar of a lot of people. And how do we fight about that?
Yeah. I'm not going to try to answer that technically because I'm sure there are a lot of American activists who could do a lot better. I'm just going to make two points. It actually goes back to the gentleman's question who just asked a question about inequality. It is very hard to maintain democratic republics in conditions of radical inequality. This is a point that Aristotle made, and unlike a lot of things that Aristotle said, you know, this one turns out to be correct. And this election, whether we like it or not, actually demonstrates that point, because you know, we can go on as much as we want about how people, you know, in Ohio or Wisconsin or, you know, central Pennsylvania were fooled by Trump, you know, about how they're terrible people or whatever, but they're not all terrible people. And a lot of them, you know, wanted to hear somebody talking about the economy and come to them and talk about the economy. And we can say it, you know, we can be economists and say what he said about the economy doesn't make any sense, and that would be true. But he came to where they were and he talked about the economy. And in Ohio, that made a lot of difference. In Ohio, that made a lot of difference. And the reason it made a lot of a difference, you know, and I accept that the racism mattered in a certain way, but the economics mattered too. The reason it made a lot of difference was that people are in fact objectively affected by what we call globalization in different ways in different places. And even if, like, all in all, you know, GDP per capita goes up, there are pockets all over the country which have been hit. And you can mark those pockets, and they overlap with Trump voting. They also overlap with opioid problems. I mean, that there are actually measurable consequences to the way our trade has changed. And that inequality does have something to do with the fact that a candidate like this could win. It's not the only thing, right? So that's part of inequality. And another part of inequality, as you quite rightly say, is that, and this is one of the reasons why the situation is alarming, is that we were already a very flawed democracy, right? I mean, we were already shifting towards from democracy with oligarchic features to oligarchy with democratic features. We were already on the way, right? The idea that, like, you have $1 trillion, you can contribute as much as you want to any candidate, and that's free speech, that's obviously absurd, right? That's obviously absurd. It means that you have more votes than me. It's obviously crazy. So we already had these problems of inequality. And that also helps to explain Trump, because what Trump said to folks was, let's admit it, it's an oligarchy. He didn't use that word, but he said, let's admit it, like, it's an oligarchy already. Let's admit it. Let's be straight. Democracy is a fake, basically. He says, Hillary has her billionaires. You just don't know who they are, right? But you know who my billionaire is. It's me, it's me. And like so many other things that he said, that wasn't true. Like, for example, I don't personally think he was a billionaire. I think he probably is now, but I don't think he was at the time. And it's also not true that he was his own billionaire, right? Like the Russian billionaires have a ton more money, like, and those are actually, like, he actually belongs to them, you know, which is a whole other story, right? But so it wasn't true what he said, but it only worked because of the inequality. Because many people already thought that it was rigged, and they'd rather have it rigged by somebody they could see than by people they couldn't see, right? And so, yeah, I mean, this is all about how even after, one can only stop this, I think, by looking forward to an America which is more democratic. You know, if we try to stop this by saying, like, yeah, everything in 2016 was honky-dory, forget it, right? Because there are too many people who know that everything in 2016 wasn't actually honky-dory, right? Okay, this is like, that's a whole other book, but I'll try to do it in one sentence. In order to be a land of opportunity, parents have to know that their children have a decent shot. When parents look at their children and think, they are not going to do as well as me, they don't have a chance to do as well as me, it doesn't matter like what their diagnosis is. They might think it's immigrants or free trade or whatever. But if the state doesn't actually set up schools and healthcare and so on so that those things are predictable, right, then you're going to have problems, right? So, yes, I mean, I think that what you're calling social democracy is a very good thing for what I would call conservative reasons. That is, if you want to have people who can be engaged in politics without fear, they shouldn't be afraid of the most everyday basic things, like not having an education, which will give their children a chance, and not having health insurance. When you play with those things, and that's part of what's happening now, and it's one of the reasons why I'm concerned about regime change, when you take away the things that hold fear at bay, you create fear as a political resource. And then you can turn that fear in other directions, right? So if we get rid of Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare, it's not just that, you know, lots of men who have guns and who need mental health care are not going to get it, right, to cite a dramatic and true example. It's not just that. I mean, it's not just that many millions of people are going to suffer for no reason. It's also that you generate you increase the absolute amount of fear that there is to be conjured with, right, in politics. Okay.
Yes, I wanted to pick up on something that you seem to be getting to. My name is Jacob Thiessen, and I am a lawyer, and I'm pleased to know that you think that the legal profession is going to be helpful, but you are not a lawyer, and I think it may be useful to remind the non-lawyers in the world that the lawyers have only a certain amount of latitude to do what they do. They, in the end, are working in a rule-bound system. Aristotle said that law is reason divorced from passion, and so a legal solution is only ever going to be a partial solution to the problems that a system faces. The political solution is always going to have to be an aspect of things. Sure. It does seem to me, and I suppose if I were to put this in the form of a question, I wonder if in your work on this book, and perhaps in future in your going around, if you would be interested in discussing this with legal scholars, because I think that the legal solutions often look very legalistic, and they often are not real solutions in the end. The political solutions are the ones that in the end really stick. So, you know, the Constitution is a wonderful thing, but the Constitution can be interpreted in many ways, and interpreted in ways that are completely consistent with the constitutional history, but that do not end up with the society that we all want. So, I suppose maybe, you know, would you
so
reflect on that?
I would be unhappy with your comment if you had said, yes, lawyers can do it all, right? then
that would have been a very lawyerly thing of
right,
me to say.
Right. But. You know, but I think the modesty with which you sketch out the problem is entirely consistent with the spirit, you know, and the argument of the book, which is that everyone can do something, right? So lawyers can in fact do things. I mean, I saw with my own eyes how lawyers had clinics at Yale, and they prepared for the possible lawsuits that they might file so that, in fact, they could file in a very timely fashion, right, when the Muslim ban came down. Mm-hmm. That's something that lawyers did. In my own world, which is a little darker, and I already said it during the talk, you know, I'm happy when lawyers aren't saying that law is about the race, right? I'm happy when lawyers are not heading up Einsatzgruppen. That may be a low standard, right? But but you know, you're sort of in a different world, I think, slightly in your. So I when I say lawyers are behaving better, I'm saying like there have been some good things, and it hasn't been a total mess. But I think law may be slightly more important than you think, because and I'm sure you know you would have a thousand. There are 1,000 qualifications you would put on this, and in better language. But the idea of the rule of law, even when we understand that every law can be understood and applied differently, the idea of the rule of law, I think, is extraordinarily important. And lawyers are among the people in the society who can talk about the rule of law, right? Who can make that norm seem real to other people. And to me, that norm is itself under threat. The other thing that I would say about lawyers, and this applies to doctors and pharmacists and pretty much everybody who's in a profession, is that the notion of professional ethics as such becomes one of the cells in a civil society, right? If lawyers say, okay, we as lawyers are not going to perjure ourselves, we as lawyers are going to condemn people who do, you know, we as lawyers have some professional ethics, which is askance, right? Not against, but askance from politics. That's one of the supports, right? One of the bastions of this thing that we call civil society. So I agree with you. I mean, we can't expect too much. And in the end, the settlement's going to be political. But I think with a little bit of creative thought, there are things that lawyers can do. Yeah.
What does State Attorney General Washington do?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he got
the
whole thing stopped.
Yeah. Well, and other people had been.
Yeah, but I mean,
people,
it took one person to actually figure out which way to go with this.
I hear you. Work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was some prior thought about that. But yeah, you're right. You're right. Okay. We're all done. I'm just terrible with this drill. Okay.
Let's take two more because we've got another event coming.
Okay. Yeah.
So in my lifetime, Watergate was an existential threat to American democracy. The major institutions of our government were suborned by the Nixon administration. There, the problem was it was hidden, and because of deep throat, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Congress, that was exposed, and that threat was defeated. Things are different this time, but the threat maybe in some ways is similar. It's going on in plain sight. I'm curious to have you reflect on how our society responded then successfully, and then what that tells us to do differently or the same this time.
Yeah, I mean that's really a question for somebody who, you know, knows a lot about American history. My whole gambit in this book is that I know something about European history, and therefore the things that I see in America, I might see a little faster, a little more distinctly than folks who are used to kind of going day by day or book by book through American history. That's the whole gambit here, right? So which makes me a non-expert on Watergate, for example. And the list of things I'm non-expert on in American history is very long, right? Like baseball in the 70s, I'm like, you know, fair, right? But and there's some other subject like FDR I'm probably okay on. Oh, America in the Second World War, probably fine. With Watergate, here's what I think, though, the difference is. With Watergate, we didn't have a problem of genre. Like, we knew that there was politics and there was reporting. And the notion that this was entertainment hadn't actually emerged yet. What we have now, I think, is a problem of genre. We don't know whether a scandal is politics or whether it's entertainment, right? So in the genre of reality TV, the purpose of a scandal is just to whet our appetite for the next scandal. And one feels this a little bit in the way we handle the scandals now. Like with Russia, it's as though like we have to prove that, you know, that Vladimir Putin created Trump in a Petri dish for there to be a real scandal. We just have this appetite for more and more and more and more. Whereas I think if we were thinking about it as politics, any one of a number of things would be shocking. I mean, the fact that he's been borrowing money from mysterious Russian sources and not paying it back since 2004. I mean, that strikes me as totally outclassing anything Nixon ever did, frankly. I mean, that, I think that puts like wiretaps and so on like completely in the shade, right? But we keep asking for more and more and more and more. And I think that's because we have a problem of genre. And I think the answer to that is that you have to, the entertainment has to become more entertaining, right? Which is why I think Saturday Night Live is doing the right thing. But we also have to reestablish the genre of scandal as politics, as opposed to just this craving for ever more. Because there can always be more, right? There can always be more. You know, if I set the standard that he has to wear a bear suit, you know, we're not going to get to the bear suit threshold in this scandal. We're never going to get there, but we can always desire it, right? Surely some of you desire the bear suit, right? Now that I've mentioned the bear suit, you're thinking about the bear suit, right? Bear suit? Okay. That's as good as I can do. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Mark Lewiner. I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I practice acupuncture. And one of my specialties is working with patients who have PTSD. And I have patients that I love who voted for Trump and patients who are really traumatized from him being president. And I'm curious, and I know you've answered this in other ways, but just appreciating this as sort of this dark cloud and this, your words, evil, this dark cloud that's on us. Is it helpful to know how this happened here in America, or is it just something that we can expect that happens with humans and countries? And
so, okay, good. Both. So we need to know that it happens with humans and countries, not so that we can separate ourselves from it, right? And that's one of the ways why I like history, because history is always all about how you can understand someone in a different place. The past is another country, but it's another country that you can go to, right? And that's what history is all about, that you see the humanity, right? That's why history is both a science and it's a humanity. It's a science because we actually have to do the research and learn the languages and read the sources and all that, but it's a humanity in that it's about making that other country a place that the reader can go to. So we have to know that it happens to people in countries for all the reasons that I tried to be clear about, because that makes the weight of it real. That makes the possibility of it tangible. It means that we can identify with other people who watch similar processes. It also means that we have a much larger group of people from whom we can learn. Because, like, much as I love us, if we just learn from Americans on this stuff, we are completely doomed. We are completely doomed. Partly because, like, we have made it a national project since 1989 to forget all the things we once knew about the 20th century, right? So we have to be humble. We have to be, I'm getting towards what America, right? We have to be humble about certain things. We have to be cognizant of certain mistakes that we've made. We have to take the other examples as human examples. And then we have to say, what can we do as Americans? Which is why the book ends on this, on the patriotic note, because it has to be America as a construction project. It has to be America as an aspiration, precisely because what America is going to be is now much more open than it was a few weeks ago. Everything we think and everything we do matters so much more. So the arc of the book and of the argument, and I hope the way it will work, is that we learn from wherever we can. We take examples from, you know, whencesoever we might, but we apply them in America as Americans, because America is the only place that we can now change. And it's what, to use a word that's really important to me, it's the thing that we can be responsible for, take our little bit of responsibility for. So that's how I see that.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.